The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Dolly Chugg. Dr. Chugg is an award-winning tenured professor at the New York University Stern School of Business, where she studies implicit bias and unintentional, unethical behavior. Dolly teaches MBA courses in leadership, management, and negotiations, and is the faculty chair of the Launch Orientation Program. She studies socially charged issues like race and gender and brings these normally undiscussed issues into the MBA classroom. Her goal is to engage business students in important societal issues and to equip them to do the same with others. Dolly writes a monthly column about race, gender, diversity, inclusion, and bias for Forbes.com, and she has a new book. It's called The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. Dolly Chugg, welcome to the show.
Oh, Kelly, thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
I loved this book, and there's a really honest and important line that you write in the preface. You write, quote, America is not always the country it means to be. To tell the truth, I am not always the person I mean to be either. What I love about that is you're taking on a lot while also, I don't know, taking off at the same time, you know, that this idea of like,
right.
Yes, the biggest things are true. And guess what? They're true for all of us, I think, is implicit in that statement.
I think that's right. I think what I was trying to do with the book and trying to do for myself in my daily life is to hold up my best self, that the person I mean to be, the title, to hold that up as a reminder and to be a little unflinching in acknowledging the gaps. And as a social scientist, those gaps are actually not a huge surprise. We know where they come from in the human mind. Once we see those gaps, you know, we can start doing the work of addressing them. But yeah, reminding ourselves of this, that there is a best self in there that we can remind ourselves it's aspirational, but it's so inherent to who we are.
And there's a point you also make where you say, quote, if you're absolutely convinced that these biases are not a serious issue in America today, my book is not the place to start. So I love that, because this is the thing at Second City we always know, which is like, there's a certain audience member, like, don't come. Yeah, honestly, you should not come if you do not want to hear satire about the world you live in. And you're saying the same of these ideas. If you don't think it's an issue, you know, this is a waste of your time.
I think that's right. And I've gotten a lot of very positive response to the book, but also, you know, some long emails or people pulling me aside to tell me all the ways in which, you know, what I'm calling bias is not a problem in the world. And, you know, I'm happy to engage in that discussion, but I feel like I should give them their money back. Like, this wasn't the book for you. If the person you mean to be is not, you know, is not an unbiased person, then, hey, you know, I owe you $20.
Yeah. So I want to jump in and talk about how we see ourselves. And regular listeners to this podcast know that I reference the work that we do with the Second Science Project and Heather Caruso and the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. You, of course, went to school with Heather. We have some debate on whether she and her husband might have met at your in your presence.
It's been on your show now, so I think it's true.
Yeah, well, we're going to make it true. So we've talked a lot about how we see ourselves, and you have a quote in the section of the book where you go, quote, each of us has an intense craving for others to see and acknowledge our various identities. And from what I know about this particular kind of science is it's not that we want people to see us as like our best selves, but they need to see us as the selves we see. about mm-hmm. ourselves, right?
Yes, totally. Yeah, like I have a 13-year-old daughter who's like a very avid Mets fan, mm-hmm. and we're you know, we live in the New York area, and if somebody mistakenly thinks she's a Yankees fan, this is like a total threat to her identity. Like, how can they think I'm a Yankees fan? I'm a Mets fan. So any identity that we value when it's not granted by other people or even by ourselves, that we just go into the red zone on that because we care deeply about whatever identities we care deeply about. One of those identities is that our moral identity, as psychologists call it, is pretty important to most people on a 1 to 7 scale. My guess is a lot of your listeners would put themselves on a 6 or 7 on a 1 to 7 scale, meaning right. they're being seen as a good person and feeling like a good person is important to them. Mm-hmm. And given that that's something that an identity a lot of people care about, what I'm really interested in exploring is how is that identity that we care deeply about in some ways caring about being a good person, how is it getting in the way of us being better people?
There's something unique inside of this concept that ties to a thing I always talk about when I get into comedy conversations. So one of the things I always say about, like, is it a joke if no one laughs, you know, or no one hears it? And identity doesn't exist without the other person, which may seem contradictory, but it's true, isn't it? That the other person is vital inside the validation of our identity.
Exactly, and you know the social science jargon on that is that we can claim an identity, but then it needs to be granted by others, mm-hmm. and so that's where this self threat comes in. The red zone of defensiveness is, if that identity is not granted by others, then we feel challenged, we feel threatened in some way. But, you know, we all claim multiple identities. So there's this interesting balancing act of what identities are being granted and which ones aren't, and then what's the craving for affirmation or identity granting that we have when we don't get that from people.
I read... When I was reading your book, you tell a story that I do want us to talk about, because a common theme that comes up in this podcast is that words matter, that over and over again, you're like, words matter. And that we keep thinking they don't, and they do. And you take this a step further in showing us that names matter. So I want you to talk about Sarah Weeks and, I'm going to try to do this, Gita Varadarajan.
Varadarajan.
Okay, close. And I want you to tell the story, and then I'll sort of chime in on how this has affected me and makes me think about this constantly.
Yeah. So, okay, the story is that Sarah Weeks is a prominent children's author. Some of your readers, they're children. I don't know if you have children listeners of your podcast, not readers, mm-hmm. but their parents might be listening, and their kids may have read So Be It, or Pi, very popular books by Sarah Weeks.
Yep.
Sarah Weeks also teaches writing classes, and she was teaching a class in which she had a very promising writer who was a full-time elementary school teacher, but was in this writing class and wrote a powerful short story about a young boy who's immigrated from India to New Jersey, and no one in his school has tried to pronounce his name, his last name. And so Geeta writes the story, and she shares it with Sarah, and Sarah says, wow, this is an amazing story. I think you should develop it into a book. I'm happy to help you do that. And, you know, I can mentor with you, or I can co-author, or I can introduce you to people. Geeta jumps on the opportunity and says, let's please write this together. So they decide to become collaborators. And now Sarah's got to introduce Geeta to, like, agents and editors and, you know, the people in her world, because she's this prominent author and Geeta's a first-time author. And Sarah is afraid to say Geeta's last name, which is Varadarajan. It's a multi-syllable South Indian last name. Mm-hmm. So she just avoids it. Like, you know, I have to confess, like, I teach in a school with a pretty global student body. And when names are unfamiliar to me, I do the very uninclusive thing of avoiding calling on those students. Right. So I can't mess up their name if I don't say it. So I'll just not call on them, which, as you can imagine, is the worst thing a teacher could be doing in a classroom. And so Sarah was kind of doing the equivalent of that. And they started really working through the plot of the story. And Geeta, Sarah asked Geeta, so tell me more about these people who aren't pronouncing Ravi's last name. Why aren't they saying his last name? And Geeta says, without flinching, arrogance. And Sarah's like, whoa, arrogance. And suddenly now, talk about identity threatening, right? Like she cares deeply about being a good person. She works hard at it. And this is being called arrogant is certainly not how she sees herself. And so that suddenly became the gateway to a conversation where Sarah just confessed that she had been avoiding saying Geeta's last name. She didn't know how to say it. She asked if Geeta would be willing to spend time teaching her, and Geeta agreed to do that. And so Geeta wrote it out phonetically. Sarah practiced saying it a couple times. She went home and she said to herself, this wasn't as hard as I thought it was. Like, if I can say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, if I can say the names on Games of Thrones, and if I can say Arnold Schwarzenegger, I can say Varadarajan. I just hadn't tried. And so it became this breakthrough, this gateway conversation into this bigger conversation between them about what are all the other things they're not talking about and making assumptions about. Between Geeta's native culture, which is from India, and Sarah's native culture, which is the United States. What I love about that story is I'm Indian American myself. I'm from northern India, my family is, and we tend to have shorter last names like Singh and my last name Chug. So I have gone most of my life doing exactly what Sarah was doing, not even trying to say longer South Indian names. And I'm Indian. So this was just a breakthrough moment for me in recognizing that I wasn't being the person I mean to be, despite my best intentions. I'm not calling on students whose names I don't know how to say. And I'm creating all these barriers and distance between people because whatever background they're from, somebody who loved them or an ancestor or a religious text, like one of the most important decisions that was made in their lives was to give them that name, that first name, that middle name, that last name, in some cultures, multiple names. And for me to not even be willing to try to put the effort in to Google how to pronounce Varadarajan, and it turns out when you Google how to pronounce and you do any name, you immediately get sound files. Like you just have to press play and like you can hear someone say it. It's surprisingly easy in the days of the internet to learn how to pronounce someone's name and to take ownership for doing that. You don't have to do what I did once, which call someone's voicemail in the middle of the night and then realize they forwarded it to their home phone.
Yeah, and they pick up. Yeah, I'm so guilty of this, and I'm not even gonna tell you who it is. Like a very dear friend of mine, I can't pronounce her last name, so I've been working on it, and then I'm tired of saying, oh yeah, you know, the flow guy, because Mihai Chikmasi. I mean, I can't do it. You write in this section, you write, quote, what are we saying about who belongs and who does not when if we treat white sounding names as the norm and other names as the variants? And that's I've never thought about it in that way. But, you know, if words matter, names hugely matter. And you know what this brought up, and it made this satire even more powerful to me, is I don't know if you're familiar with the Key and Peele show from years back, but those are both Second City guys, and they had this amazing sketch where Keegan played a black substitute teacher in an all-white school, and he couldn't pronounce the white names. Aaron. So he couldn't pronounce Aaron, Denise, or Blake. He's like, what are these names? And it was always very funny. But now you're like, oh, that is actually a penetrating piece of satire.
Right. Wow. Yeah. And actually, now that you say it, I think I did see that years ago, but didn't make the connection. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Sometimes comedy can sneak it in there. Okay. So here's another. My office mate, Scott Zoll, is listening to your book after I started reading it.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, no, don't talk to me after this. I'm not there yet. Because I was like, hey, have you gotten to the shame and guilt part? And he's like, no. But he did today. And he's like, oh, my God. So this is, this is a stunningly simple but interesting piece where you say, quote, "I encourage you to consider the difference between shame and guilt." I never considered the difference. Talk to us about that difference, because it's powerful.
Yeah, and it turns out, like, if there's a whole academic field out there about this.
Who knew?
I think the person who's most associated with this distinction is Brené Brown, the very widely read thinker and author and professor. So the way she describes the difference between shame and guilt is that shame is when you feel bad about yourself as a person. It is like an all-encompassing. And what research shows is that when you feel that you have failed as a person, that we tend to act less, we withdraw effort, we shut down. Guilt is that you feel badly about something you've done. So I feel badly that I excluded that person, but I don't feel that I am a bad person. And when you feel guilty, what you tend to do is actually move into action mode to fix the thing you did wrong. And so what we're aiming for in this effort of trying to be the people we mean to be is to actually lean towards guilt, not shame, because it's more likely to put us in action mode. What shame sends us is back into that red zone of defensiveness. You know, we're not going to sit in shame for too long. Our brain will find a way. As it always does, it'll do the gymnastics to sort of redeem ourselves. And then that's where we get stuck in, you know, I'm so committed to being a good person, I'm not letting myself be a better person by learning from my mistakes.
Yeah. So the idea that guilt is pro-social was kind of new to me. In the same way, I remember talking to Dacre Keltner, who talked about the pro-social aspects of gossip, that it's a way of sort of checking ethical behaviors. And I'm like, that's really interesting, because I think we grow up, and this is what this book is so much about, and it's a perfect transition, because you have this term that I think Beverly Daniel Tatum came up with, which is smog, which describes these cultural associations that are laden with unconscious bias. And I feel like this is all sort of connected. It's like we sort of just grew up thinking this is a bad thing, or this is a negative thing, and we don't recognize that all these forces are at play. That when someone says, like, I don't think I'm biased, or I don't see bias, like, it's such a ridiculous statement, because what superpower do you have that you've been able to shield yourself from the way that society has been? I don't, like, did you read a history book?
Right.
We're not that far away from some of these terrible, terrible structures.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so Beverly Daniel Tatum describes smog as, like, from the moment we're born, we're internalizing, we're taking in the world around us, right? Constantly, constant images around us, sounds around us. And all that is smog in the sense that we are internalizing the associations around us. So if we live in a culture where there's lots of negative media associations about Black people, whether or not we believe that to be true, we are internalizing it when we consume that media. If we live in a community where people of color are always in service roles, we are internalizing an association between skin color and who's in charge or who's a leader. We could keep going with every gender and body type, and we could just keep going with that. So yes, that smog is something we're breathing in, whether we want to or not. And the work is around trying to, A, shape the smog we're living in now. We can't change the smog of our past, but we can think about what smog we're sort of surrounding ourselves with on a daily basis going forward. And then to think about, for the whatever we have internalized, how do we unbiasing ourselves is not scientifically something that we've quite figured out how to do. But we can unbias systems around us and processes around us. You know, there's all sorts of neat studies out there that show that, for example, if you take names off resumes, you can debias the process in pretty significant ways, a hiring process and so on. So there's a lot we can do about that smog.
I think the thing that sort of resonated a lot with me when I first started studying behavioral science in the way that I do, which was realizing that we tell ourselves all these stories to make sense of the world. And, you know, we're really mm-hmm. shitty narrators of our own stories and often of other stories.
Yeah.
And so you have what you talk about, the hard knock life effect. So mm-hmm. I'll explain what I do and then you can talk about the science behind it. So I have this thing I do when I talk about where I grew up, which was Kenilworth, Illinois, which is one of the richest suburbs in America. And I always note that my parents were among the first Democrats and the first Irish Catholics to live in Kenilworth. I talk about the fact that my dad ran away from home when he was 16 and that my parents didn't have money. I immediately go to this story about, you know, potentially how rough I had it in the mean streets of Kenilworth, which anyone like who hears the story is like, what are you saying? And I didn't realize until I read your book that there is actually a, you know, a phenomena that I am participating in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you're not alone in that. I mean, I think that's the thing, the hard knock life effect that my colleague Taylor Phillips and her collaborator Brian Lowry came up with is the idea that we tend to, when we're told of hardships others has faced, and, you know, I do this when my husband comes home, he'll be like, oh, the day I had, and, you know, he'll give me mm-hmm. his day, you know, run down. And then I, of course, have to come back with, you know, wait till you, they tell you about my day and, like, you know, this and that and my commute and the kids. And there is this, like, innate one-upsmanship we tend to do. It's compounded, though, the one hard knock life effect is that when there's group advantage involved, so
right.
in particular, what they found is that when white participants in a study were told about ways in which there was inequities for blacks, they tended to recall more hardships in their own life
yeah.
and in their background.
Yep.
So their history didn't change, obviously, and they weren't lying. It's just, you know, glasses half empty, glasses half full. They sort of focused more on the ways in which their group and they were disadvantaged themselves in some way. It's a really interesting when you see yourself doing it, and I know I see myself doing it a lot.
Yeah. Well, there's this whole a few different things. I love the science behind faking it to make it kind of thing, because mm-hmm. that exists, mm-hmm. which is one way to go. We talked about the sort of when you understand the stories, and if I'm in the storytelling business, so it's interesting to me to look at different ways to tell my story or understand someone else's story. You use this term of looking for us to be builders in response to all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
And I want you to talk to us a little bit about, like, how can we become skillful with regard to being a builder, which I think some others might call allies. I think I prefer the term builders.
Yeah. And it's interesting, when I first started working on this book several years ago, like, this is before there was an agent or an editor involved, I was describing it as a book about allyship and how to be a better ally. That was my little pitch about the book. And then the more I dug into how the term was being used and how the term was being perceived
yep.
by particularly people of color and activists, the more I realized it was a bit problematic. And this story actually will explain how we ended up with Believer versus Builder. What was happening is that a lot people were claiming to be allies and claiming the identity of being an ally and not waiting for it to be granted by others. So in other words, I declare myself to be an ally to gay people,
yeah.
and then I sort of expect the affirmation, expect that identity to be granted, but I'm not actually doing anything to support gay people other than, like, claiming that I support gay people. So I'm a believer, but I'm not building more equitable workplaces. I'm not engaging in any actual activity. And so as a result, the term ally has taken on a real negative connotation. And there's, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your show.
Yes, you
but
are.
There's, I am? Okay. Yep. So, I mean, there was a really powerful Facebook post that somehow someone I know liked, so it showed up on my Facebook feed, where this person who I eventually interviewed for the book was just talking about fuck your allyship and like went off on how she really was frustrated with the use of this word and the emptiness of it. And so it was that actually led me to be like, if I can't use this word, what word should I use? And then I started saying, well, I think what I need to distinguish, I think what's being lost in the use of the word ally is this difference between a lot of us believe in diversity and inclusion. Most of us, I mean, it doesn't always feel that way today, but most of us actually do.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between believing it and actually doing something about it. There's a difference between believing it silently and taking action and having courage, even if it's small, little, semi-bold steps.
I like it. And I immediately reflected on when I first met Heather Caruso up at the University of Chicago, and we would get in these marathon, like, four-hour conversations, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. We were talking about, could we co-develop a class that uses improvisational practices and behavioral science that gives people agency to bring this into their life as they graduate from college, because we were tired of the ladder metaphor. Because you know you're climbing the corporate ladder, but what happens when you know get to the top? Where do you go? There's only one way to go, and that's down.
Right.
And she talked about the metaphor of a house, or not even just a house, because some people don't want to live there. But what is a place that you want to live that can expand and collapse based on how you feel and where you're at? And so, you know, for her, it's a house with a variety of rooms, and this goes on in this room, and there's another room there, and if you have a child, there's a child's room, and for another person, it might be a boat, you know. But it's like, where are you living? Because it's not necessarily vertical, which is a weird place to be. And again, it goes back to these presuppositions, these assumptions, these biases, which are rampant in us. And we're just living with them because no one has made the change, because everyone freaks out because suddenly they get weird about gender pronouns. I mean, I find this argument that becomes a right-left issue, which is just so stupid, around gender pronouns. Mm-hmm. It's like, maybe just call someone what they want to be called. I mean, I think that's respect and kindness. I don't think it's liberal. So,
absolutely. And this is, you know, I learned this wonderful metaphor that I've found really helpful, is when it comes to technology, we assume that we are going to constantly have to be a work in progress and learning new things. And now how do I upload this and download that? And, oh, somebody show me how to do this. And I'm going to have to ask an expert. I'm going to screw it up. And we assume that we're every year going to have to learn something new and adjust. What if we thought about these issues around diversity and inclusion the same way?
Yes.
We don't think of ourselves as works in progress. We think of ourselves as, like, we're supposed to know how to do this, and if we don't, we're a sexist or a racist, or you're a sexist or you're racist. And so gender pronouns are a great example. I mean, there's, you know, a piece in the book about that, of like, I'm really trying to catch up on that subject. And this idea of being a work in progress is very consistent with Carol Dweck's work on fixed mindset versus growth mindset, where fixed mindset means you sort of, you are where you are, whatever level that is. Growth mindset, you're a work in progress. And in my book, I describe it as being a good person versus a goodish person. A good person is a fixed mindset. I'm a good person, red zone defensiveness. If there's any evidence otherwise, that means that I'm going to shut down when I make mistakes. I'm going to go into shame mode. I'm not going to learn. Brain activity is going to go down rather than up when there's opportunities to learn. As a goodish person, I'm actually going to, when mistakes happen, of course it's going to suck and I'm going to feel guilty, but I'm going to actually see my brain activity go up, because I'm going to say, okay, now I've got to figure this out. How do gender pronouns work? And these are the moments as a goodish person where we're actually going to notice and own our mistakes instead of deny them and reject them because they challenge our identity.
Yeah, one needs to think of their bias as a floppy disk. If they, like, You can't even use it anymore.
God, floppy disk.
Or, you know, like, I always make the joke of like, thing about the game Myst, you know, like it's like, there's all this stuff that existed when the internet was starting to happen and that, you know, you would never, think about it as like, oh, it's so antiquated. It's so old. Of course we've moved on. But to your point, because things like bias are reflective in our popular culture of you being a good person or a bad person. And this is the left and the right are guilty of this. This is not just owned.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I've noticed, especially in my social media feed, because everyone's fighting with each other in the speed in which they can shame one another or otherize one another for otherizing. So I don't know how we get out of that cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely happening on both sides. And I will tell you, my book is not political, but if you made me pick an audience, if you made me pick a political audience, I'd say it's for liberals because I think liberals are particularly guilty of sort of claiming this moral high ground. And we put ourselves in an awful tight corner when we say I'm a good person and there's no room to grow here, as opposed to I'm a goodish person, lots of room to grow, you know, lots to be proud of and lots to aspire to.
I haven't read it yet, but it feels like the book that just came out, Winners Take All, shares some of that, but from a reportage, you know, point of view, because I don't think he's an academic.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't read it either, though I did listen to an interview of it. And I actually, it's a good example of it, because I think his claim is around, you know, like, for example, a TED conference basically being just a lot of everybody patting themselves on the back
yes.
And then leaving feeling like we've done something as opposed to it's sort of a classic believer versus builder thing. And I recently gave a TED talk, you know, that I was all feeling all proud of. I heard that interview and I'm like, oh,
geez. Yeah, here we go. I listened to a podcast too. I think it was On Being, and he talked about being an Aspen fellow, and I've presented at the Aspen Ideas Festival twice. And I reflect back on it's so privileged and it's so beautiful, and you're exchanging these ideas, and everyone is and you're like, oh yeah, what have I done, you know, really to affect the underlying structure here, which is the problem.
Exactly.
And look.
Or have I just reinforced it, actually?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know, you couldn't wait until the year after my TED Talk.
To ruin my TED Talk for me. All right, we just don't have to think about it. All right, I could talk to you all day, but I do have to wrap up the podcast. And we always ask our guest for a yes and story. So this is in the concept in improv, of course, is that you can't get anywhere by saying no, and you actually just can't say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I do, but I will tell you that when I asked my family about this, like, could they help me think of a story? They were all like, you're more of a no, but.
Oh, no.
Like, oh,
that does not seem to be the case. This is terrible. I'm sorry.
Like, that's not true. My yes and story actually began with a no, but I think I get most improved player here because being an academic is a second career. In my first career, I was in business. I have an MBA. And I was kind of cruising along, but could tell I hadn't quite found, you know, like my passion to play into that whole passion evangelism. And I was chatting with a friend of my dad's who's a psychologist and an academic. And we were talking about the things I love doing. And he said, it sounds to me like you need to go get a PhD and become a professor. And I was at this point like 30 years old and I already had an MBA. And I was like, no, but I don't think that's going to happen. Like, you know, I'm not just starting all over again. And so I totally disregarded it. And I thought I totally disregarded it, but I think what I did was actually park it in my brain.
Yeah.
And it turned into a yes and, because 2 years later, or maybe 3 years later, at age 33, I started a PhD, gave up my six-figure job and started all over, got to meet Heather Caruso not too long after that. And I feel like it was the best professional decision I ever made. I'm doing work I love, teaching, research, writing, it's for me been the best yes and ever.
Yeah, I would second that, because these principles and these ideas, as you know, are so powerful, but they're hard, and we need good storytellers to be able to not fudge it, not Malcolm Gladwell it, but you know, mm-hmm. to really give us ways in which we can understand. And the thing I love about this book is it is rigorous. The evidence is the evidence, but it also is laid out and written in such a way that anyone, you don't need to have a PhD, you don't need to have even an undergraduate degree to be able to read this and understand mm-hmm. it. So I really appreciate it. The book is called The Person You Mean to Be: How Good People Fight Bias. Dolly Chugg, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, this means so much to me. Thank you, Kelly. Well, I've been working in a home.